Welcome to Voices of NCAJ. We're talking to members of the North Carolina Advocates for Justice about what it means to be a trial lawyer, what it takes to be great at the practice of law, and how being a part of NCAJ enriches their lives and careers. Produced and powered by Law Pods.
Welcome, everyone, to Voices of NCAJ, the podcast for the North Carolina Advocates for Justice. I am Amber Nimix, your host and Director of External Affairs for NCAJ. Before we get started, I'd like to thank today's episode sponsor, Advocate Capital. Advocate is passionate about helping plaintiffs' attorneys get better results for clients, mainly through their AdvoTrack case expense funding service. It allows firms to track case expenses and recover borrowing costs, which makes the net cost of borrowing zero on cases they win. Learn more at advocatecapital.com. My guest today is Chris Edwards. He is the co-chair of Warden Smith's Appellate Practice and North Carolina State Bar Board Certified Specialist in Appellate Practice. Chris focuses his practice exclusively on appellate litigation in state and federal courts, with a particular emphasis on the U.S. Court of Appeals. He is also a frequent author of amicus briefs for NCAJ's legal affairs team, and he has just begun writing a new column for Trial Briefs, NCAJ's quarterly magazine. It's called Appellate Thinking, and the column aims to provide trial lawyers with an appellate attorney's take on trying cases. Next month, Chris will lead a one-hour CLE on this topic titled Winning on Appeal Starts at Trial, Issue Preservation and Record Building. That'll be on Wednesday, November 12th at 12:30. You can learn more about that and all our upcoming CLEs and register at ncaj.com/events. Chris, welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm really glad to be here.
So how did you arrive at appellate practice as your focus? Was there a turning point case for you, or was this always what you wanted to do?
So the answer to that question is interesting because I think I've always wanted to be an appellate lawyer, but I don't think I knew it for a long time. During my 2L summer, I worked for a firm that we spent a lot of time writing and editing. I thought, well, this is kind of cool. From there, I got a clerkship in a federal district court and then the U.S. Court of Appeals. And those clerkships were sort of predictably monastic. We spent a lot of time reading and writing and researching. And so for the first 4 years that I was in practice, that was all I knew, was writing for, talking to, persuading judges. And so when I came out into private practice, I did spend some time trying cases, doing discovery, doing the day ins and day outs of litigation. And I just found appellate practice more rewarding. I think a lot of lawyers get out of bed in the morning because they want to help their clients and they like to fight for their cause. And I think that that's what the NCAJ, so many of the members do that. I love to help my clients, but I also really like thinking. I like putting those ideas on paper. It's sort of like a puzzle. And so I've always liked learning about different areas of law. I've always liked studying different areas of law, different cases. And I think that's what drew me toward appellate practice. No day's the same. I handle a wide variety of cases. I've handled patent cases. I've handled employment cases. And I've handled negligence cases. So it changes every single day, and I'm always learning something new. And so I think that is what really drew me to appellate practice.
So it's kind of like everybody has a superpower. And for trial lawyers, for folks who like to go to court, it's pretty obvious how they're directly helping their clients. Is like, you know, they're in court and they're fighting it out. But like for an appellate lawyer, you're still using your superpower. It's just not, you're not necessarily, you know, wearing a cape.
Yeah. I'm not the type of person to put in front of a jury and convince the jury of your cause. But what I do like to do is I do like to tell a story. It's just a different way to tell it in an appellate brief. You know, you're still conveying your client's story. You're still putting your client in the best light and you're mixing it with the law. And it's just a different approach to do the same thing. I don't spend a lot of time, like I said, in the courtroom, but it's still the same storytelling narrative, although it might be a little bit different, right? Because your audience is different. So you have to tell a little bit of a different story.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. So in this column that you're writing now for Trial Briefs, which goes out to our membership, which is primarily folks who are in front of juries or who are, you know, litigating and they have that different audience, you're trying to sort of share some of your superpower with them in a way that helps like give their practice a different dimension, right?
I think that's right.
Because the better you are at appellate thinking, the stronger your ability to represent your client all the way through, right?
That's right. And, you know, even if you're not going to represent your client all the way through, the better you are at understanding the nuts and bolts of appellate advocacy in the trial court, the better your chances on appeal are going to be. Nobody takes a case thinking they're going to lose after putting what may be years of hard work into it. But the reality is you have to at least have that possibility in the back of your mind. And so as you take steps through the trial court, through the trial process, whether it's discovery issues, a motion to dismiss, a motion for summary judgment, you've got to think strategically about how to make the right arguments at the right time so that if things go badly, you can have those arguments preserved and ready to present on appeal. So that's the first thing, is just making sure trial lawyers understand the full array of options they have to preserve issues for appeal and then to make those, because if they're not preserved, they're not available for selection, no matter who is handling the appeal. And then, yeah, you're absolutely right. I think that my other goal through writing this column is really to help improve the quality of appellate advocacy throughout the state. I think our bar is, we've got a number of phenomenal appellate lawyers. And I think that if our appellate advocacy overall is better, it makes our court system better, it makes the outcomes better, and it helps the courts do their job. I think both of those goals. One, just to make sure that trial lawyers preserve and understand why they're preserving. But two, just to increase their skills so they can represent their client all the way through.
Yeah, I did a story about Wade Bird, legendary trial lawyer this summer. NCIJ gave him a lifetime award. And two things that they said about everybody I talked with said about him as a lawyer. One was that he could create a relationship with a jury like nobody had ever seen before. That's unique and legendary. But the other thing that they said, everybody said, was he was the best prepared lawyer that they had ever seen. And you can have one and, you know, you can be the most charismatic, likable person on earth. But if you can't like back it up with what you need to like make sure, like what you're saying, you have the goods to preserve these issues on appeal, then you're not giving your client the best chances possible, right?
And that's right. And there's a difference between being prepared for trial and being prepared to preserve issues for appeal. And that's, I think, what makes it challenging for people who straddle the line and work in both worlds. Because asking questions on cross-examination on the fly is an incredible skill, but also knowing when to stop, when to object, and what to say when you object to make sure you're getting the right answer, or at least an answer out of a judge, is another type of skill. And there are people who can do both well. But I think that one thing appellate lawyers offer to trial lawyers in particular is the knowledge and the comfort that they can handle those other technical aspects, which allows the trial lawyer to focus on actually trying a case. And I do that a lot in my practice, working with trial lawyers to try and get the best outcome in that way. But you're right. It's a skill. You've got to be prepared. And it's just a different level or a different type of preparation. And it's one that not everybody thinks about.
You wrote your first appellate thinking column for Trial Briefs. It was in the third quarter edition for us. And you focused on Vanguard v. Moody and the lessons that trial lawyers can learn about best practices from that case. What were a few of the lessons that you went over in that column?
That was a really interesting case, and I think I would be remiss if I didn't acknowledge, yes, the Court of Appeals had done a number of these cases, had decided a number of similar issues before, but I think this is the first time the Supreme Court adopted the practice, and it's about specificity. Everybody knows, or every trial lawyer knows, about moving for directed verdict for judgment as a matter of law. You renew those after trial. And what the Supreme Court makes clear there is, if you're going to make the motion during trial and after trial, your motion during trial has to be clear about the issues that you're raising. And it's easy to make a general motion. It's easy to think that that is sufficient, because I think a lot of people often feel like, well, this is going to just result in kicking the can down the road. The judge is likely to give the case to the jury. But if you're going to set your client up for the best chance on appeal, you need to know what you're objecting to or what your arguments are on the fly as you make the motion orally. In that case, I think it was the president or CEO of a corporation had been charged with fraud or had been sued for fraud, and he challenged specific aspects of the fraud claim during trial. He challenged specific aspects of the fraud claim, and then he brought a number of new theories on the written motion after trial, and the court said that that wasn't enough to preserve those issues. So if you're going to make an argument, it needs to be specific and tailored to the facts of your case. And I think that a lot of courts are trending that way. It's no longer just enough to say objection. You need to have a clear idea of the legal basis for these arguments. And so that's just another example of where appellate thinking may be at cross purposes with trial thinking, because, you know, if as a trial lawyer, you don't want to irritate your judge who's administering this trial, but you've got to do a certain amount of that. You've got to do a certain amount of work to make sure that you have the best record to put up in front of the Court of Appeals and maybe the Supreme Court.
That's interesting when you talk about, you mentioned trending, you know, like one of the things that appellate lawyers, I think, have an opportunity to look at is where the case law is taking us. And having interviewed Sam McGee a couple of times, our legal affairs counsel for NCAJ, and talked with him about how NCAJ looks at taking on amicus briefs and what you really have an opportunity to see what's going on in the minds of the judiciary, right? When you take a look at a case like Vanguard, was this one of those moments that you said, ah, this is something different or new, or this is something we should really pay attention to, right?
To your bigger point, yeah, that's one of the fascinating parts about being an appellate lawyer is watching how settled case law changes or evolves over time. And it's sort of like what you do in law school, but it's different because you're doing it in real time. It's not these moments in time that have been picked out for you to study. You're reading opinions and comparing them to other opinions, comparing them to the work of other justices or judges. And you start to see individual personalities, individual preferences, individual approaches, the authors of those opinions, but you also see where they're moving the law. With Vanguard in particular, I think that was important because it's the Supreme Court blessing a practice that the Court of Appeals has been employing for a long time. But, you know, that's not always the case. Sometimes the Court of Appeals can apply a rule and the rule shows up in multiple cases, and the Supreme Court may just disagree, but may not take it up. And so in this case, you know, it gives us clarity as lawyers in North Carolina how that is going to work. And I think that that's important, not just in this procedural context, but in the bigger picture. You know, for example, there's a recent-ish opinion out of the Fourth Circuit where that court essentially disregards the Court of Appeals. It says, under federal law, we're responsible for predicting how the state's court of last resort is going to rule in on this, and we think the Court of Appeals is wrong. And so by having clarity out of our Supreme Court, it removes that layer of uncertainty. And I think that Vanguard is a procedural issue. That wouldn't be an issue, a problem in federal court, but I do think it's indicative of what people should be looking for. Even if they're tried and true in the Court of Appeals, you get that clear rule statement out of the Supreme Court, it gives you another layer of certainty that transcends the venue that you're trying your case in.
Wow. So you've been focusing on appeals for most of your career, right?
That's right. Most of the last 10 years.
How much more interesting has your professional life gotten in the last, 5 years than in the first 5 years? You know, obviously, I don't have a law degree. I've never practiced law. I've been writing about lawyers and working for lawyers for the last 10, 15 years of my life as a journalist and communications professional. So, you know, I'm just sort of have a ringside seat here. But it seems like the last 5 years have been a much more interesting, maybe the last 10 years have been a much more interesting time to practice law at the appellate level than maybe the previous 10, 20 years. What do you think?
Yeah, you know, law shifts, the trends in the law shift. And so I think what you've seen in the last 5 or 10 years is just a definite shift in the trends. You saw it at the federal level. I think you saw it when Chief Justice Earl Warren was replaced with Chief Justice Warren Burger. And every chief justice, every new justice moves the court in a different direction. And you've just got to figure out what it is. our state courts are a little bit more volatile than that, just because there are elections and they're much more frequent than a justice on the U.S. Supreme Court would be replaced. But it's the same thing. It's just mirroring trends in the law and seeing where the law is moving. It takes some resilience because, you know, things that you understood to be settled, you've got to adapt if those decisions are reversed or changed or limited or altered. Take the Chevron case that the Supreme Court overruled in Loper Bright Enterprises. A number of people had built practices around Chevron deference. I'm sure there were hundreds or thousands of cases pending at that time where they were briefed around Chevron deference. And so you've got to really be willing to do the work, to change your thinking, to think on your feet, to get around some of those evolving legal problems. It requires new strategies and it requires persistence, because I think you've seen lawsuits be filed with shifting theories just to try and understand how the Supreme Court's decisions are going to work out in practice. So it's been really interesting to watch law evolve over the last 5 years. And, you know, I'm sure it'll continue to do that going forward, but it's definitely made it an interesting time to be an appellate lawyer. And if you're trying to get to a court of last resort, if you're trying to get the U.S. Supreme Court or the North Carolina Supreme Court, or if you're asking the Fourth Circuit to review a case en banc, so before the whole court, it kind of plays into what you think is cert worthy or review worthy and what you're asking the court to do. So it's really, I mean, it's sort of an academic exercise. You've got to really understand what people are interested in. It can be a little bit breakneck lately, though.
May you live in interesting times. Be it a blessing or a curse, right?
That's right.
So you recently co-authored an amicus brief for NCAJ in Cottle v. Mankin. Tell us about that case just a little bit.
Yeah. So the Cottle case was interesting. I think there were a lot of legal issues in the case. The one we focused on was whether a negligent supervision claim is a medical malpractice claim. And it's really about statutory interpretation and what types of businesses or entities or physicians' practices in this case can be subject to the medical malpractice laws. And medical malpractice laws, as I'm sure almost every listener knows, they limit the types of claims you can bring. They impose procedural requirements on those claims. And so it's really about asking the Supreme Court to, in my opinion, to be faithful to the text of the statute and to take these negligent supervision claims against practices outside the ambit of medical malpractice, because that, I think, most significantly for the Cottles, would remove their claim from Rule 9J, which requires an expert to pre-review your case. And so it's an important case for, in that respect, just sort of clarifying the law. And it was an interesting case to write. I worked with two other authors from NCAJ, John Moore and John Ward, and we passed drafts back and forth and found a voice that worked for the whole brief. And it's a great exercise in teamwork. It's a great contribution, I think, to the jurisprudence of the state. It's a really important opportunity. And so I love to do this for NCAJ because I think it's really important, you know, whether you want to establish yourself as an appellate lawyer or an authority in some specific area of that the plaintiff's bar is interested in, whether it's personal injury, med mal, whatever. I think that this gives you the ability to do so. And I think that it's just a great opportunity to work with and meet other lawyers from around the state. And so, yeah, it was a really rewarding experience. It was an interesting case, sort of a targeted brief at one issue, but we managed to spill a little bit of ink on it. So there was enough to say.
So when Sam McGee gives you a call, you should definitely answer, yes, I will be. Yes, I will be willing.
Absolutely. Yeah. Because it's so much fun. The recognition is nice, but, you know, just doing it and being engaged with it and learning, like I said earlier, learning about a new area of the law is fascinating.
So you're going to be leading this upcoming one-hour CLE for us and addressing some of the challenges that can make an appeal feel overwhelming for lawyers who generally are more comfortable in the trial realm. So you work with a lot of lawyers, trial lawyers, on their appeals. What's the process like for you working with trial lawyers?
Sometimes they come to me before trial. Sometimes they talk about, you know, issues for summary judgment. Sometimes it's after trial. And the process is very much the same either way, or at least my thought process going into it is, you know, nominally, as an appellate lawyer, I am working for your client. But practically speaking, an appellate lawyer's client is the trial lawyer. And so it's never been my practice to try and step in between the lawyer and his or her client and to take over that relationship. I really like working with and collaborating with the lawyer and helping him or her solve their most interesting problems. I think that's the best part about being an appellate lawyer. I tell people that I get to help my friends solve cool problems. And so that's the first part. As far as what that's like, it also depends on the stage of the case, because sometimes if it's post-trial, there's a really quick burn. You have to learn a lot because you need to ask some important questions in the coming days. But if it's pre-trial, you know, you're talking about strategy, you're talking about trial strategy, you're talking about, you know, the way that the trial lawyer will frame certain evidence, the way that they'll make certain arguments, present it. Maybe you divvy up the motions in limine, what have you. And then eventually when you get to the appeal, when you get post-trial, I've done everything from give really quick advice about the record on appeal, timing of an appeal, to, you know, handle appeal through oral argument. But it sort of depends on every case. I think it's really easy to think about the rules of appellate procedure and about the appellate process as being fixed or uninteresting because there are such rigid deadlines that are clearly spelled out. But every case has its own complexities. And so, you know, you're, what if somebody takes a interlocutory appeal? What if the notice of appeal is improper? You've got to address those issues. I'll say most of the time when I'm just talking to a trial lawyer in the first instance, there are two or three things that come up most commonly. And so the first is, what is the timeline for this? Because appellate timelines vary. I mean, there's obviously the timeline for filing the notice of appeal, but a lot of people's clients aren't really concerned about the notice of appeal. You know, maybe you've lost, maybe you've won. When am I going to know whether I actually won or lost is often the question people want answered. And so a lot of what I do is talk to them about the speed of the appellate courts, what we can do to speed things up, what we can do to slow things down, just pace it. And so another common question is how to handle post-trial motions. There are a number of cases from the North Carolina Court of Appeals about when a post-trial motion is proper and tolls the time for taking a notice of appeal. And there are just as many cases saying that some post-trial motions are not proper and they don't toll the time for taking the notice of appeal. And so you talk to your trial lawyer colleague about, this has tolled your time. No, this isn't effective and you need to file your notice of appeal now. Or maybe your opponent has appealed and then you're talking about when to move to dismiss the appeal. Are they going to exceed their time for filing a notice of appeal? And finally, you know, I get a lot of questions about just assembling the record. And it's sort of it's a mundane task, but the record tells a story. It tells your client's story. And it needs to identify in relevant part what happened at trial. And so I get a lot of questions just about that process and how to tell that story. So it's a really rewarding experience to work with trial lawyers. I love getting calls about just, hey, how do I do this? Because I think that, again, like I said earlier, improved appellate advocacy betters us all, it betters the court system, it betters our outcomes. And so, you know, I really like working with people, even if it's just to answer questions that I deal with a lot, because those aren't questions everybody else deals with every day. So I sort of do everything, and it takes a lot of different shapes and forms when I work with a trial lawyer.
Well, I can't wait to hear more about that. I guess it's virtual, right? The 1 hour CLE.
Yes, the CLE is virtual. And like you said, we're going to cover topics about preserving issues on appeal, putting your record together. So that's going to be really more trial practice focused in some respects, offers of proof, timing for filing motions, things like that, that you need to do as a trial lawyer to ensure that if your evidence is excluded or what have you, if the case doesn't go your way, you're able to set yourself up to succeed on appeal.
Awesome. Well, Chris, thank you so much for being on the podcast today. I really enjoyed talking with you.
This has been great. Thanks so much for having me. And I look forward to working with the listeners. And I hope that they enjoy my column coming up.
Yeah, absolutely. Everybody be on the lookout for Chris Edwards' column, Appellate Thinking in Trial Briefs, NCAJ's quarterly magazine. And for more on how to think like an appellate attorney, register for Chris's 1 hour CLE on this topic. Winning on appeal starts at trial, issue preservation, and record building. That's on Wednesday, November 12 at 12:30. You can learn more about that and all our upcoming CLEs at ncaj.com/events. Before we go, I'd like to thank our Circle of Leadership Gemstone Level founding members for supporting NCAJ's mission and this podcast. You can see a list of Circle of Leadership firms and find out how your firm can join the circle at ncaj.com/circle. Thanks, everyone, for listening.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of Voices of NCAJ. For more information on the North Carolina Advocates for Justice and how to join or support NCAJ, please visit our website at www.ncaj.com.